Your local children's hospital is full of superheroes. Superhero patients. They wear gowns instead of capes and often fight evil on a microscopic level. And just like the doctors, nurses, and staff, you can help decimate illnesses and enemy foes for sick and injured children by gaming. Join Extra Life, a community of 50,000 gamers that play games and heal kids. Register at extra-life.org.
Hey, nerds. We understand you. Drop those controllers. Lose the wizard hat. And ready your Cheetos. It's time for some hard-hitting talk about the movies, books, and games you love. So get ready, oh searcher of useless knowledge. It's time to step into the Geek Cave. Now, broadcasting from a top secret and totally awesome hidden base, I'm Kent Harris, and here's Darren Wright, Justin White, and Chad Savage.
And welcome to another edition of Certified Fresh-ish Geek Cave Podcast Movies. I'm Darren.
I'm Justin.
And I'm Chad, reminding you that you can never be sure you've seen an entire movie because blinking exists. Welcome to Geek Cave Podcast. We're Shirtosaurus, digging up where we are sponsored by Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from the past so you can look rad today with great t-shirt, sweater, and hoodie designs on everything geek chic. Whether you're a fan of old school gaming, anime, 80s cartoons, or you're just weird, find something for you at Shirtosaurus.com.
No. I like that we are Shirtosaurus. Hey, Shirtosaurus, look at me. We are Shirtosaurus now.
And also brought to you by Gamefly, with membership options for every budget plus gifts for gamers of all ages. Gamefly has thousands of titles you can keep as long as you want. When you're done, just send it back with the posted paid envelope for a new one. Or keep it forever. Pay a lot less than in-store prices. Sign up for a free 30-day trial right now using the link at geekcavepodcast.com. All right, guys. For this month's Extra Life ad, I asked my boyos to join me, so please welcome the uncivilized quartet of Chad, Brad, Thad, and our Romanian cousin, Vlad.
Time now for Extra Life donations. Help us to help sick kids. We're gonna play a full night and day. Trying to make a difference in this. We're gonna offer prizes through the day. All you have to do is give a little bit, then you can. You'll be a hero. So give. You'll find the link to give. So give. Just find the link to at geekcavepodcast.com.
Wow. Yeah.
Thanks, fellas.
Vlad is my favorite.
Well, you know.
Sorry, buddy, but you know.
It's all right. I get you.
I like all of them.
So.
You're just chicken to announce who your favorite is.
Yep.
Well, just a lot of work went into that and a lot of coordination. So I've done that work. All you got to do is find the link. The song told you where. Man, you know, I was just talking with my spouse today that I wish I had taken flight lessons. Like that because not even big planes, just little ones. Because. Mm-hmm. Well, one, it would make visiting long distances easier. And two, I could call myself a pilot. And I could go to various and sundry social events of a raucous nature where other pilots would also be. One might even call it a pilot party. And I know that you, Justin, have some experience with such things.
I do. Please welcome to the stage, Run DMC!
Pilot!
Pilot Party!
Welcome to Pilot Party, where I review an entire TV series based only on the first episode. Why only the first episode? Because back in episode 124, it seemed like a good idea, and now I'm kind of stuck with it.
Continuity!
Yay!
So this month, we look at the dark comedy horror show Scream Queens, starring none other than the queen of all Scream Queens, Jamie Lee Curtis.
All right.
1995.
Bad year for me.
Kappa Kappa Tau sorority house at Wallace University is having their weekly party, whatever.
Right.
Amy stumbles downstairs, her hands soaked in blood, and warns current president Bethany that her friend Coco and Mandy that something has happened in the upstairs bathroom. They enter the room to find Sophia holding a baby that she has just delivered in the tub.
Oh, my.
Disgusted, Brittany scolds Sophia for leaving the party so she could go dance to TLC's Waterfalls, because that's her jam.
I mean, yeah.
So after Waterfalls, they come back upstairs and they are shocked to find that Sophia is dead. And now they have to cover up the incident.
Did the baby do it?
Jump to 2015.
I know what you did 20 years ago.
Gaga doo-doo, mother.
The modern day Kappa Kappa Tau is ruled by the cruel, vain Queen Bee, Chanel, and her minions, who she doesn't care to learn the names of. They're just Chanel 2, 3, and 5. Yes, there was a 4, but she died of meningitis.
Oh my. So the queen bees here, Chanel and so forth, they do not operate with Spectre logic.
No.
Everybody didn't get a promotion.
Nope. Dean Kathy Munch, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, hates sororities, especially Kappa, and doesn't want the system that they have to carry on. She sees them as a bad example of what girls are doing these days. In her office, Munch tells Chanel that she thinks she is the one that injured the previous Kappa president to get her position. Now, when I say injured, I mean the previous president was being spray tanned, and somebody had put hydrochloric acid in the spray tan machine, except tanning solution.
That'll happen.
During that flashback, as the other girls run out to get help, we see from the former president's viewpoint somebody in a Red Devil costume. You know, that's a kind of a flash, and it's gone. And the dean says she's going to revoke Kappa's charter. Well, enter Gigi Caldwell, the president of the national chapter of Kappa Kappa Tau, and a lawyer, and says, you can't do that. So the dean, in her own way, compromises and comes up with the idea that, fine, if I can't get rid of you, I'm going to make your life miserable. And we'll circle back to that in a minute.
Okay.
Cut to Grace Gardner arriving at Wallace University and bids her father, Wes, a tearful goodbye. She befriends roommate Zeta, and they plan to pledge to Kappa Kappa Tau together, even though Zeta is hesitant. At the rush party, the dean announces that Kappa is required to accept anyone who wants to pledge. Not just the popular and the pretty. And I mean everyone. This runs off a bunch of people. The only ones who are left are Grace and Zeta, along with Hester, or as she's called by the Chanels, Neck Brace, because she's wearing a neck brace.
Mm-hmm.
Tiffany, or as they call her, Deaf Taylor Swift, because she is a hearing impaired individual who loves Taylor Swift and thinks that's what everybody's talking about.
Ah.
And Sam.
I mean, they're probably not wrong completely.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. And Sam, or as they call her, Predatory Les.
Oh.
Okay.
All right.
That took a turn.
Yes, it did. The dean also introduces Jennifer. And Chanel is terrified because she finds out Jennifer is a candle vlogger, where she smells candles on a vlog.
Why does this upset her?
Because she's vain and that's beneath her somehow. They didn't explain. She just finds that horrible. So Chanel runs to her boyfriend Chad for comfort. He tells her, well, you're not popular anymore. Your sorority's not, so I can't date you, babe. Sorry.
That's totally a Chad thing to do.
Yeah. So Chanel, in order to run off these would-be pledges, she comes up with a prank with the sorority's maid, Miss Bean. The prank is going to basically dunk her head in a fry vat to scare everybody off. Now, the fry vat will be off, of course.
Okay, I was about to say, because that's not... that's assault. That's not a prank.
I don't like where any of this is going.
Yeah.
Right now. It's called Scream Queens.
Yeah.
Yes, it's called Scream Queens. Grace, in the meantime, meets up with Pete, who's at the local coffee shop, and tries to advise her, don't pledge. There's something screwy with sororities, especially this sorority. And Grace assures Pete that, yeah, she'll be fine.
I didn't pledge a sorority, I can't tell you.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Back at the house, the prank starts, and Chanel dunks Mrs. Bean's head in the fryer, accusing her of theft, and decides, you know what, I'm not just going to fire, I'm just going to kill you. Unfortunately, the fryer is actually on.
Yep.
Called it.
Yeah.
And Miss Bean's face gets, you know, deep fried. Well, they're not just going to call the police, because that wouldn't be a story. So they move her to a walk-in freezer.
Huh. It's not going to make her better.
Where upon going back to the freezer, the body is missing. Later.
She had somewhere to be.
Later.
Like an ER.
Yeah.
Later, Chanel number two decides, I can't stay quiet about this. I'm leaving. And she goes upstairs to pack. While packing, someone in a Red Devil costume shows up in her room. They have this funny little back and forth where she gets a text message and it says, look behind you. She does. And there's the Red Devil. And she types, no. They have a whole text exchange while standing right there. I'm going to kill you now. No. Let the stabbing begin. Chanel number two kicks the Red Devil off just long enough to reach her computer, get to the Facebook analog for the series and type, help, the Red Devil is attacking me, blah, 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 blah. And before she could hit enter, she's stabbed.
Was this made by the same people who made Scary Movie?
No, because it's slightly better.
I don't know. That first Scary Movie was pretty good.
Scary Movie is pretty good.
Yeah. Okay, it's better than the, you know, subsequent ones.
All right.
Okay.
The other girls find Chanel number two. Take her to the freezer, because that's what you do, and decide, well, we're just going to move on with, quote, Hell Week, which is where you put the pledges through hell. So everybody but Grace, because she's not around, is buried up to their necks in the backyard where they're to stay overnight.
This is all one episode.
Yes, this is...
Jesus.
Yes. The Red Devil shows up on a lawnmower and runs over deaf Taylor Swift, who before seeing the lawnmower sees all the other girls screaming, thinks they're singing Taylor Swift, begins singing Taylor Swift, sees the lawnmower, begins screaming. Now, normally this is where I would stop because that's technically the end of the first episode. But episodes 1 and 2 aired back to back simultaneously, so I'm going to keep going with episode 2.
Okay.
Because it's, and that's how it's aired on Hulu, so it's,
yeah.
As Hell Week continues, they hire a detective, or they get the police come in, and a detective is looking into the issues, and they hire a security guard. And I mean that in the loosest term, because she's not licensed to carry a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
But what she does have is a walkie-talkie. If she is on the premises and you yell her name, she will come running and assist. If she is not on the premises, you dial this long 1-800 number and the company will call her on the walkie and she will come running.
I feel safer already.
And if you can't get through on the 1-800 number, you dial this other number. Yeah.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Grace and Pete have kind of bonded over the extreme goings-on.
Sure.
And have a bit of a detective streak in both of them. So, Grace has uncovered a mysterious locked room in the basement of the Kappa house. She's going to break in and see what secrets are inside, because she was told only the president has the key to that room. Pete is going to break into the dean's office because clearly something's being covered up. Pete breaks in. He finds a file labeled 1995 Kappa Kappa Tau incident. And before he can look at it, he gets knocked out by the Red Devil. Grace breaks into the room, finds the bathtub from 1995, and then is confronted by Chanel, who's told some secrets are better left, you know, left alone. Right. So, as the night goes on, Chanel is still trying to figure out what to do with these pledges that she doesn't like. The security guard, she goes upstairs and is attacked by the Red Devil. We don't see this, but she says she is.
Okay.
She runs downstairs screaming. The security guard shows up, and all the girls want to go back upstairs because, well, he's upstairs. We got to stop him. And the security guard's like, you want to go back upstairs where this killer is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Stupid white girls. And the security guard leaves, only to find her partner dead in the car, and she takes off, scared out of her mind. The body falls out, of course.
Right.
Inside the Kappa house is a message written in blood that says, sluts will die. The next morning, the security guard comes back and says, yeah, my partner was dead and the body's missing. And bro dude boyfriend, whose name I don't remember.
Chad.
Yeah, sorry, Chad.
Oh, yeah.
Shows back up and says, yeah, my buddy Boone, who, you know, his best friend who I didn't talk about, is also dead. He was killed by the Red Devil. His throat was slashed, and he was left ritualistically on a table. The show ends with the Red Devil showing up to the morgue, pulling the drawer out where Boone is. He wakes up, takes a piece of prosthetic off his neck, revealing he's in league with whoever the killer is.
Okay. All right. Twist.
This show is stupid, but in all the best ways. The over-the-top nature of the situations and sometimes the acting fits perfectly. A lot of the deaths aren't even actually shown. They happen off-camera or the scene will change just before. You just see the aftermath. And the ones they do show are one step above what you would see in an 80s slasher flick.
Okay.
So even when the maid gets her face deep-fried, it's like, yeah, no, that's bad makeup right there.
Okay.
If you love horror, this is a great parody of that genre. None of this is to be taken seriously at all.
Well, that makes me feel better.
Yeah, that's...
It is not done for the gore. It is done like, oh.
It's done for the lulz.
It's done for the lulz. Like, I've seen that done before. I've seen that. I've seen a person killed like that before.
I've seen that done well.
Yes. Now for my predictions. The Red Devil continues their murderous rampage throughout the school, and eventually we're left with Grace and Chanel. As they search for clues, it is determined that Grace was the baby born in 1995. Her father lied about her age to keep it a secret. Grace concludes that the Red Devil is her father, finally seeking revenge upon the death of her mother. Nope, Dad ends up dead in the next scene. The devil kills Grace and knocks out Chanel. Turns out the Red Devil is actually Dean Kathy Munch. Or should I say Dean Laurie Stroud. That's right, in yet another timeline of the Halloween franchise. Laurie assumes the identity of Munch in order to escape her past and the association with her serial killer brother, Michael Myers. But as time went on, she too went deranged. Using the events of 1995, she set up an elaborate plan to kill off most of the popular girls at the school, cementing her status as Final Girl Supreme. She frames Chanel for all the murders and sits back in her office smiling, waiting, hoping for there to be another batch of girls she can make examples of. And then she's killed by her brother. Credits.
I was hoping it was Chanel number 4.
No, she died.
No, I know, but yeah. Like that's like a red herring. She's not actually dead.
I give this 8 bro dudes hitting golf balls at hippies out of 10.
Okay, so not a bad score. Yeah, it's a lot of bro dudes.
It's a lot of bro dudes.
It's not for everybody because it is a horror show, but the horror is played up for laughs sometimes, and it's done just campy enough to be a step above old slasher movies, but well below gorer films.
Okay.
This is nowhere as gory as Saw would be.
Well, it's hard to do that. Well, thank you, Justin.
You're welcome. I'm sorry it ran long, but like I said,
It was a two-parter. Yeah. Well, that's all right. Maybe this will help. There are a lot of shows out there that live in the memories of TV land. Some of them are given new life, some relegated to the dustbins of history. This segment show asked you about one such forgotten piece of television history and asked, should we review it? It was good then, the original's just as good now. Reboot it, the idea's sound, but we can modernize it and capture some magic. Revive it, what are these characters doing after a couple decades of growth and development, or refuse it? Chad, there are no words right now. So I will be shocked if either of you know this show. By me saying this, it guarantees that not only do both of you know it, you either loathe it or love it already.
Oh, boy.
The cartoon had 13 episodes. It aired on Kids WB in 1997. We are keeping with the theme of anthropomorphic animal hero teams for at least another couple months. In this case, we'll be following the exploits of Hunter, a Goldador, Colleen, a Collie, Exile, a Husky, Blitz, a Doberman, Shag, an Old English Sheepdog, and Muzzle, a Rottweiler, that together make up the team of heroes known as the Road Rovers.
Yes! I do not know this one.
Chosen from around the world, these first 5 dogs are treated with a transdogrifier ray that turns them into Kano sapiens. And they are going to be sent on an important mission.
But oh my God, I do know this one.
Yeah.
But first they have to greet one another, which is done just off camera where it's implied that they are sniffing one another's butts. But they're not dogs at this point. They're humanoid dogs. So they're all like, it's awkward.
Yep.
They each have their powers. Hunter's fast. Colleen's a martial artist. Blitz has super jaws. Exile super strong. Shag is big. Their mission is to stop some other mutated canines from stealing and using some kind of gene splicing device. This is just the pilot, by the way. The first episode.
Yeah.
That's all well and good. When they find out that some of them may not come back, that is, you know, perish, they don't want to do it. After all, they're putting their lives on the line. What's in it for them? To which their master says they will get 3 meals a day, a bath once a week, and a carpet by the fire where they can sleep. They come together to discuss and then demand the sofa. To which the human master that transdogrified all of them gets really authoritative and says, you will stay off the sofa.
Yep.
And they are cowed. And, you know, also if they succeed, they'll each be given a home.
Yeah.
So, standard cartoon fare. Lots of jokes, lots of puns. The secret base entrance has a giant doggy door. They win their victory. They get their homes. You know, Hunter gets to live with Bill Clinton. Colleen gets to live with the UK Prime Minister John Major. Exile with Boris Yeltsin because it's the 90s and Russia's not the bad guys anymore.
Right.
Blitz with the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and Shag with Arnold Kohler. the president of the Swiss Confederation. So they together will eventually fight against General Parvo, who is later discovered, by the way, spoilers, to be a feline sapien.
Yep.
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 So I don't have anything else to say at this point. So what say you? Are we reviewing, rebooting, reviving, or refusing Road Rovers?
Jim Cummings voiced General Parvo, by the way.
Yeah.
And so
Tress MacNeille was Colleen.
Yeah. And so Colleen is why I remember this show, in that like it was
Did
just
you
one
have
of,
a thing for
no,
Colleen.
No, I didn't have a thing for
because
the human dog.
Because they moved
I know
they moved the dog breast from like the abdomen area.
I know. Yeah. They made them humanized. The only reason I remember is like the other day someone on like Reddit's like our animation, I think okay. it was like, you know, do you remember this character? And it was just a still image of Colleen. And I'm like, God, I remember the dog. I don't know what it's from, but I remember the dog. And as soon as you started rattling it off, I'm like, God dang it. All right. So long answer to a simple question. No, don't. Don't bring this back in any way, shape, or form. I remember enough of this cartoon to know that it was, there's a reason it only lasted one season. It was god awful. I watched like two episodes of it, and I love dogs, and I'm like, I hate this. So, and that was back when I was a kid, when I liked garbage. I hated this. So no, now I'm not a fan of Road Rovers. No.
There are no words.
There are no words. No. I didn't think that first episode was that bad.
No, but just that was the high point.
No.
It just gets worse from there. It's one of those where, like, even as a product of its time,
yeah.
It's like, you guys are like, this is like getting, like, it's hysteria is better, right? But you're not quite into lunatics yet, you know? Remember Lunatics?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not that bad, but you're getting there. So, no. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I watched some trailers.
Okay.
So, we're just going to round up some. Migration. Illumination's making another movie. This time it's about ducks.
Ducks! I did see this.
Is it Croods but with ducks?
Yeah.
Probably.
Yep.
The Great Escaper. Hello, Michael Caine. playing a World War II veteran that escapes the nursing home to visit France to honor his, you know, fallen military buddies on like the 70th anniversary of D-Day. It's Michael Caine, so it's probably going to be at least high caliber acting. Nominee for Feel Good Story of the Year. The Exorcist Believer. Hello, Ellen Burstyn.
Yep.
You know what we need? An Exorcist sequel trilogy. Yeah. An Exorcist sequel trilogy sounds like a great idea. On the bright side, the music is absolutely perfect.
Oh, yes.
If you haven't seen the trailer, music is right.
I just want to watch Repossessed again.
The Kill Room. Hello, Sam Jackson and Uma Thurman. A money laundering scheme accidentally creates an art sensation, and I'm kind of looking forward to it. A Million Miles Away. Hello, Michael Pena. A dramatic retelling of Jose Hernandez's journey from migrant farmer to astronaut. Nominee for Feel Good Story of the Year. She Came to Me. Hello, Peter Dinklage. And Anne Hathaway. And Marissa Tomei. A composer has a muse that's also a stalker. Looks funny in that independent film twisted kind of way. The Marvels. Hello, Brie Larson. Iman Vellani. Tiona Paris. It looks very Marvel-y. Lots of shiny lights.
I'll probably see it.
Yeah. Best moment is Kamala reacting to Goose eating some people. Saw X. Hello, Tobin Bell. Can we say that this is the last one until some weird ill-conceived crossover with Child's Play, please? You know, one doll and the other doll. Zombie Town.
Marionette murder.
Zombie Town. Hello, Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase. Still working, I see. So movies are turning people into zombies, but we already knew that. This looks stupid as shit. Perfect for high schoolers. You are so not invited to my bat mitzvah. Hello, Adam Sandler. It's a Netflix teen drama. I can't help but hate it. Kraven the Hunter. Hello, Russell Crowe. I love how we keep turning villains into heroes for their own movies. You know, like Venom, Joker, Cruella de Vil, Maleficent, Hannibal Lecter, Thunderbolt Ross. It's almost as though the eroding moral ethical center of our society has reached a point where any behavior can be contextualized so long as there's a sufficient tragedy at its core. But maybe I'm just full of shit.
No.
There's stuff here that I want to see. There's a lot more that I don't. But I do have a question. It's based on that Saw X. You know, it's a throwaway gag, right? The little doll from Saw, the marionette with Chucky from Child's Play. But what would really be the most ill-advised horror movie crossover?
Well, they are making a Barney one. It's not a horror movie.
Barney with gremlins?
No, it's not a horror movie, but like it's a live action Barney where he's dealing with the cynical nature of today's generation.
And wasn't Barney that called was Death to Smoochie?
Yeah, Barney yes, was terrifying. That's a good as movie. Is. Yeah, Barney was terrifying as is, but okay, gee, I gotta think about this one. What would be
ill-advised horror movie? I mean, cuz they crossed over Freddy and Jason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They crossed over Aliens and Predators.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the Critters and Ninja Turtles.
Technically, they did.
I mean, Critters. The marquee was
yeah,
there.
Yeah, the marquee. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do they come up with this stuff? That's when you knew that Raph was a real New Yorker.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a part of me is thinking, you know, the hillbillies from Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Yeah.
All right.
You mean Tucker and Dale?
No, the hillbilly, the guy who, the college student, the one that they killed at the end.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, know, yeah, yeah, yeah.
With
yeah,
the yeah. T or whatever.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. It's like, I think, put him into Cabin in the Woods.
Okay. Okay. You got your gremlins.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You got the Purge. It writes itself.
It does.
So
I might actually watch a Purge movie in
so
that
this
case.
Is, I know you were thinking ill-advised, but like all I could think of was, God dang, the gremlins would work well in the Purge.
Man, wouldn't they just?
Musical wouldn't numbers just and everything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Killer clowns from outer space.
Right.
Versus the killer tomatoes.
Ooh.
Okay.
All right. Nice.
Little Shop of Horrors on Sesame Street.
Ah.
You got your musical numbers. You got your talking plants. You got uncomfortable stuff.
Manos, the Hands of Fate.
Manos.
With Iga. That was a Richard Kiel movie.
Yeah, never seen that one.
Oh, my goodness, my friend. You are missing out.
It's
not going
to
go on the okay. list. It's,
Roller.
No, if we're going to, that's a party game.
Oh, okay.
That's we all get to enjoy EGA. That's not just you and me.
Thank you.
I did
thank
bring
you.
Riff Tracks a game with me.
See?
So, brilliant.
Yeah.
Roller Gator and literally any other movie.
Roller Gator with terrible. Tammy and the
yeah,
Tammy and the
Tammy
T-Rex.
And the T-Rex. Oh my god, Roller Gator's so bad.
So, all right, movie reviews. Darren, you saw a movie?
I did see a movie. You ever think about death?
Constantly,
yeah.
Especially since like 2 days ago when you were,
yeah. Only on Thursdays.
Yeah. Well, that's fair.
That's my me time.
That's fair because today's Thursday, according to people who watch this out, listen to this outside of the early access from the Discord. But yeah, that line kicks off a wild series of events in Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen the trailers, and we all agreed this movie looks bonkers. And I can confirm, after having seen it with my niece, this movie is bonkers.
You don't have to cover up by saying you saw it with your niece.
No, no, I did take her to see it. I also enjoyed it thoroughly. I'm comfortable in my masculinity.
Darren is not the kind of guy to sugarcoat whether he's going to see a movie for himself or not. He's not going to.
There's some truth to that.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, I wore a pink shirt and everything. I was here for it. I also dragged her father along, and I don't think he was into it, but I was into it. But yeah.
But that's the best part, isn't it?
But yeah. So the Barbie movie, and I'm very, very vague here on the details because I don't want to spoil anything. I'll go ahead and say watch it. See it. And the complaints that I've seen from some very thin-skinned people about this beats up on men. No, the actual message of the movie is just don't tie your worth to another person. And that is a message that is addressed both to Ken and to Barbie. Mm-hmm. For Barbie, it's tying her worth to the little girls that, you know, play with her. For Ken, it's tying his worth to Barbie.
Right.
And the message is the same. Don't tie your self-worth to someone else.
Not a bad moral.
It's a really good message. Now, along the way, there's some great humor. I loved the bit where, by the way, Margot Robbie's version of Barbie, because there's different versions in Barbie Land, is called Stereotypical Barbie. And she refers to herself as Stereotypical Barbie throughout the film, which is just a fun little nod. she gets out of bed. It's one of my favorite gags, and it's early on. She gets out of bed. She takes off her slippers. And you know how all Barbies are, like, standing on their tiptoes?
Yep.
That's her feet. Until she starts, during a dance number, like, do you guys ever think about death? And, like, the whole party shuts down for a second. Turns out that whoever's playing with this Barbie is thinking about death at that particular point in time. And then Barbie starts getting a crisis, and her feet go flat, like a normal person's feet. And to the other Barbies, it's the most disgusting thing they've ever seen. And eventually she has to go to the real world to find out what's going on and how to fix it. Will Ferrell is the CEO of Mattel in this movie.
Of course he is.
And it is a great, great job by him. Everyone is delightfully silly, and the movie doesn't take itself too seriously. It does earn that PG-13 rating for a couple of jokes that, like, if you take a kid under the age of 12 to this, you're going to have some questions that you need to answer after the film. But yeah.
And how old is your niece?
13. 13.
Okay, right on the wire. Right.
Hi, Adrian. Okay. She's listening. Hi, Adrian. It's worth seeing. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Anyone who, you know, feels they've been threatened by this film probably needs to stop taking themselves so seriously.
I saw a fan theory online that Will Ferrell's character in this movie, the Mattel toy exec, is also the dad from the Lego movie.
I could actually see that. There's some similarities.
Who is, through a strange turn of events, Buddy the Elf. He's gotten more cynical as time's gone on.
But see, that's the thing. Like, and this isn't a spoiler, but I love that, like, you know, Will Ferrell plays a CEO. But it's not your stereotypical, oh, it's the evil CEO. No, this guy is genuinely trying to do the right thing. I can't say enough positive about it. It's earned the ridiculously staggering amount of money that it's made. It beat The Dark Knight in the domestic take. Barbie beats Batman is an actual headline. So, yeah. Kudos to Margot Robbie. She's made a shit ton of money.
Pink is better than black.
Apparently.
All right. I also watched a whole bunch of things. Good Omens 2, featuring John Hamm, David Tennant, Michael Sheen in their devilishly angelic roles. This season of Good Omens lacks the urgency of the previous season, but retains a good deal of the humor and is a worthy follow-up.
It's on my list.
The ending promises to be divisive, unless a third season is on its way. But it still gets an A for me. Scorned, 2013. You know, revenge movies can be a lot of fun. John Wick is delightful. In this film, starring Billy Zane, Viva Bianca, and Anna Lynn McCord. So Kevin and Sadie have been dating for about 6 months, and Sadie thinks that he's going to pop the question. Unfortunately, she discovers that he's been cheating on her with her best friend, Jennifer. And it's at this point we find out that Sadie has a few screws loose in her head, and she takes revenge in a manner that is both gruesome and completely outside of reasonable for the offense. C. Don't see it. It got a C.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha.
The Color of Magic. Based on the first two Discworld books from Terry Pratchett, The Color of Magic, which is Octarine, by the way, stars David Jason as the cowardly and failed wizard Rincewind, who has the body of a long-distance runner in the books. Sean Astin as Two Flower, the disc's first tourist. Tim Curry as Imper Trimon, an aspirant to becoming the Arch-Chancellor. Brian Cox as the narrator. Christopher Lee as the voice of death. And David Bradley as Cohen the Barbarian. This captures so well the tone and humor of the books that, quite honestly, it was nearly impossible for me to be upset with the changes that they had to make for it to work as a show. It was a two-parter on BBC. If you're a fan of Pratchett or Discworld, or you just like British humor, absolutely worth the experience.
A. All right.
Stand and Deliver. The 80s. Telling the true story of a bunch of unmotivated kids learning and passing a difficult mathematics test is not a bad idea. Having Edward James Olmos as the teacher who motivates the kids by going around them instead of trying to confront them directly is interesting. However, doing so by taking the true story and condensing it from an 8-year, you know, thing to a single year stretches the credibility so far past its breaking point into fantasy that I thought for a second I would see unicorns. Showing Jaime Escalante building his math program over several years, it would have been a better, more believable movie. Just straight up. And there's good actors, performances in it. I love the grittiness of the world. It just... the story made everything just a little bit too perfect for what's supposed to be an underdeveloped kind of area. It's still getting a B because some of those performances were really fantastic.
Yeah.
Also, it's definitely a product of the 80s. It may have been made in the 70s. I don't remember. I didn't look, but it's definitely a product of when it was done.
It's an 80s movie.
All right. Ghost Town. Now, I'm not really a fan of Ricky Gervais. I find him grating. So it makes this particular role really good for him because he's a grating character that's put off by everyone around him. So Gervais plays a dentist that delights in making sure that his patients can't talk by sticking foam in their mouth like he's not some vicious, weird, you know. Anyway, and he's the kind of guy that if you asked him the time, he would look at his watch, look you in the eyes, scoff, and then keep walking. Right? That's... so he's got to have a routine colonoscopy, and he dies for about 7 minutes. That puts him in this half state where he can see ghosts. That makes him a magnet for all the dead people of New York that want him to take care of their unfinished business so they can move on. For someone that hates people, he has now significantly increased the number of people who want his attention. The main plot of it involves a cheating Greg Kinnear and his widow, Taya Leone. It's a lightweight rom-com. It's believable as a magic show, but the acting's good, and despite it being a bit sappy at the end, probably worth your time. It's a good B-movie. Hard Candy. I'm not entirely certain how to categorize this one, all right? Hard Candy is mostly talking. It stars Elliot Page, credited as Ellen Page, as Haley, a 14-year-old girl, and Patrick Wilson as Jeff, a 32-year-old photographer. The movie begins in a chat room and the two meet in a coffee shop before eventually going to Jeff's house. So we're already creeped out, right?
Yeah.
This is something is off. We don't like this dude. We don't get a feeling about this dude. He makes her a drink and she's like, no, everybody knows you don't drink something that somebody else mixed for you. So she goes and mixes her own drink and she's doing that. She also mixed his and he passes out. He wakes up tied down, and the whole expectation of what was going to happen just flipped itself right the hell over. Because Haley seems to have some proof that Jeff's been involved in the rape and a murder of a young woman. and as punishment, she castrates him. Ooh. Using a medical guide, the internet, and a whole lot of ice. Now, it's fake, but that scene, when you watch that scene, it don't look fake.
Mm.
Like, it's they're not showing what's happening to him. What they're showing just him in close-up as she's... Because it's constant talking. As she's talking through all the things that's going on and what she's doing to him, in quotes, you know. This movie is super intense. Part revenge, part cat and mouse. It's crazy. It deserves watching, but so cautiously. Like, you've really got to be exactly in the right mood to watch this. And I don't know what that mood is.
Gotcha. Wow.
But it's an A movie.
Okay.
It's crazy. Nobody. This was easily my biggest surprise of the month. Bob Odenkirk, you know, Saul Goodman, Mr. Show, just hits it out of the park. He portrays Hutch Mansell, a man whose daily life has become so routine that it has worn away at his relationships, his job, his very soul. And then there's a break-in in his house, and he chooses not to act. He's got the drop on him. He's got the golf club. He chooses not to act, earning himself some disdain from his son, his neighbor, the cops. And it's only when his daughter says that her kitty bracelet has gone missing that it seems to awaken a streak of violence in Hutch. He tracks down the robbers. They don't have it. While riding the bus, some hooligans cause some trouble. This scene, the bus scene, should stand right next to the Daredevil hallway fight.
Okay.
Ooh.
All right. Because we know that there's something about this guy, you know? I mean, just in the box art, right? His dad is Christopher Lloyd in the movie, which is also very cool. But the opening of it is so clumsy, right? Because he's not been fighting. He's been a routine dude, you know, missing the garbage day, so on and so forth. But as the fight goes on, and it's like he finds his groove in it, and it just becomes this beautifully brutal kind of thing, nearly artistic in its violence. I was practically cheering, and it's only like 92 minutes long.
Nice.
The movie, not just the bus fight. The bus fight, 92 minutes. Woo! No. It is a thrill ride. It is worth every minute. If you get a chance to see Nobody, do it.
Okay.
A movie. That is all I have except for the random movie review, but I think you had a question for us.
Well, we have a question from the Discord, so be sure to join our Discord, dkpodcast.com. You can find the link there. Today's question is, this was basically spun out of a discussion about Deadpool. Could we have a Deadpool Wolverine kind of musical moment? Mm-hmm. And what is your favorite musical moment or one you would like to see?
Favorite musical moment in recent years is the We Don't Talk About Bruno.
Yeah.
Where, because it's a Madrigal, right? So a Madrigal is a bunch of individual melodies that play off of each other. And that is a brilliant one that really worked well to put all those pieces together, because it's like seven different parts.
Right.
And it's a very, technically speaking, it is a very good, you know, impressive piece of music. And every time you listen to it, you can listen to a different part and hear how it kind of fits together. Kind of like, is it the opening of Phantom of the Opera, where there's another one like that, where you have a bunch of people singing kind of different.
Right.
Yeah.
For me, it would be from Hamilton, Angelica's song, Satisfied. Where the cast goes backwards a little bit and kind of reenacting some of the events from the prior song. And just when you go back on subsequent watches and you see all of these elements that were in fact there during Eliza's song right before, Angelica's, and just how coordinated it all was. It was just a wonderful aha moment for me. So I would say that's probably mine.
The Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
The big show at the end. Cab Calloway has done his thing. The audience is ready. They come out. Silence. And then they launch into Somebody to Love.
Mm-hmm.
And then wins the crowd over. But I love that song. I love that movie. And just that... crickets.
Another one that's fun for me, guilty pleasure for me, is the High School Musical trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
The second movie where Zac Efron, Troy Bolton, kind of has this mental breakdown on a golf course. And, you know, he's trying to look like a tough guy when he's like jumping into a sand dune. And for whatever reason, my headcanon is that like the neighbors or no, someone like on the next hole is watching this idiot just kind of like, you know, jump around and like... and slap the water hazard, and it's just I can't not think of it in that context. And question asker, yes, I do want to see a Wolverine and Deadpool musical.
I mean, yeah, but only if you could also get Spider-Man.
Turn off the dark.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be at least one musical moment in Deadpool 3. There has to be.
One would hope.
Yeah,
I would hope so. I did enjoy. The opening sequence to The Greatest Showman with Hugh Jackman.
Oh, Greatest Showman.
Barnum.
Greatest Showman is such a wonderful musical and such a giant piece of fiction, but such a wonderful musical.
It is. It is not historically accurate in the slightest.
But I love the songs.
There are a couple of things that, you know, P.T. Barnum was a person.
Yes.
He did create a circus. At one point, his building did catch on fire. Everything else?
Yeah.
But up for debate.
But yeah, that soundtrack, yeah, one of my favorites.
Oh, the soundtrack is good, yeah.
I tend to go for villain-type songs.
Mm-hmm.
I like those usually, but they're the ones that where you really get to cut loose on them. And so... I like the Merry Murderesses, you know, the Seven in Chicago.
Yeah.
You know.
He had it coming.
That's
it.
Yeah. Thank you. Also liked Devil Take the Hindmost, which is from the second Phantom of the Opera movie play. And I don't remember what it's called, but I remember that song. It's... Raul and the Phantom basically making a bet together.
Okay.
And it's really cool, really well done. I did like the Captain America song. I mean,
from Rogers the Musical?
Rogers the Musical. Yeah. I mean, that was not bad. The opening one. The one at the end of the series was a little bit long.
But Magic Dance from Labyrinth.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. David Bowie, Muppets.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong.
Well, I mean, and if you're going to get into the Muppets kind of stuff, I mean, that's a huge...
That's its own
separate question.
Yes.
I mean, the opening to Treasure Island.
The opening to Muppet Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol, or just When Love Is Gone from Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's so many... You can't do Muppets without just...
No.
We're going to have a Muppet show now.
Mm. Yeah.
So, well, that's a good question.
Welcome to the Geek Cave. This
good
is
question.
So, I guess we're ready for the.
Ooh, pick
me.
Pick me.
Yeah. Darren.
Yeah, one more thing.
And now it is time for Darren's Trivial Trivia.
Okay, so Lord of the Rings, right? The Fellowship of the Ring.
Somewhat familiar with it.
Fellowship of the Ring, you know, the first one, right? You remember how they did all these on-location shots on, like, mountaintops and all that stuff? Well, the cast often had to fly to shoot those locations by helicopter, all except for one. Sean Bean was afraid of flying, right? So when Boromir had to be in a scene on the top of a mountain or crossing the snowy mountains, he would spend 2 hours every morning climbing from the base of the mountain to the set near the top, fully dressed as Boromir. The cast and crew would pass by him as they flew up. This happened day in and day out until they got it done.
Wow.
That's all I got.
Wow. I expect nothing less.
All I know is that Jerry Ray Ray Tolkien would be proud. Isn't that what
Jerry
it stands for?
Ray,
close enough.
Ray,
J-R-R, Jerry
yeah,
Ray
I
Ray.
Get, yeah.
Yeah. My spouse is
Kent,
kill me
save
when
me.
She hears this.
Oh, the lights are down low. The popcorn is hot. The drinks are cold. Settle in for the cinematic universe of Chad's Random Movie Review.
By the roll of the dice, the next movie I review is Hard Ticket to Hawaii. Hard Ticket to Hawaii. Sounds like porn. All right. Operation Mincemeat, however, was the movie for this month, and that was the codename for the plan to deceive Hitler as to the Allies' plans to attack Sicily. So it involved a disguised dead body, a whole load of other deceptions, and so on and so forth. Now, imagine that story. You know, we're going to deceive Hitler by dropping a disguised dead body with a whole bunch of secret intel into the ocean to be caught, to be found by the Spanish, who are corrupt as, you know, spit, who are going to turn over this stuff to the Nazis, and it's going to save just tens of thousands of lives. Now imagine all that written by Ian Fleming.
All right.
The author of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and some British spy novels that were turned into a fair number of movies.
Indie movies, weren't they? Like low budget.
Yeah, Eon oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. kind of stuff. So rather than getting into the totality of the plot, because the plot is a 2-hour story narrated by Fleming, or at least narrated by the guy who's playing Ian Fleming, about the trials and tribulations of putting together a plot, the film is British through and through. It means that there is a tremendous amount of humor in it if you have a dry enough sense of humor to find it. That humor is as dry as the desert in a drought. Colin Firth and Matthew McFadden carry the movie as the two leads. Their professional, mildly antagonistic relationship, because they both have developed feelings for the same person, despite Colin Firth's character being married. And it's very weird. That being said, John Madden, not that one. his direction is super clear. So the courage to let the actors work, the camera stays put. It's a very old-fashioned style of filmmaking. So you're watching it and you feels, even though this movie was made just in the last few years, it feels like a movie that was made like in the 80s, but with today's, you know, technology. And so the camera doesn't do a whole lot of moving around. It doesn't bounce around. It stays put and you let the actors do a thing. And then the actors might walk off screen and you still look at a thing for a while. You're setting a tone. You want to make sure that you know that this is a wartime London, right? It plays into the movie's strengths. It occasionally veers into more of the spy movie territory, but that's to make sense of the narrator. You know, if the whole thing is being filtered through James Bond, then you're going to have that. Yeah. The movie's engaging, at times slow. It's bogged down most when it's dealing with the romantic triangle subplot that probably didn't really exist in real life, but was entered into the movie for the purposes of extra drama, because World War II did not have a compelling villain.
No.
Or enough drama to carry a movie.
The sequel is never as good as the first one, so yeah. I can understand that.
I defy that, because Godfather 2 was a bloody masterpiece.
Okay, typically.
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 I think my favorite part of the movie, which I don't know what it says about it, is when the most emotionally distant person in the movie is tasked with writing personal correspondence, like fake personal correspondence, that then has to be approved by a committee. Because throughout this entire thing, everybody is talking about how everybody is writing books. You know, all these generals and admirals and captains are writing books. Ian Fleming is working on his books, and all these people are writing books. And here's a guy can't get a letter through a committee because it's either too dry or too boring or too informal or too this or too that. This guy can't put three words together without somebody pointing out how bad it is. So, if you're not terribly sold on the mostly true story of Operation Mincemeat, there's a second movie here. And that movie is the prequel and story behind Ian Fleming's creation of James Bond, where we find out why is he called M or Q? Where do we get the idea for all of the goofy gadgets? That's also happening in this movie. It's circumspect, but it's still there, and it's kind of clever.
All right.
You know, the movie zigs and zags in different ways to worthwhile payoff. It's not doing anything particularly new or interesting, but it zooms along at a brisk enough pace to keep interest. It's worth watching. I'm glad the dice were kind enough to give me a good film to watch, so be like me. With no other business, thanks to our sponsors, Shirtosaurus and Gamefly. Check out news and reviews not on the podcast on the website, geekcavepodcast.com. Join the Discord for fun conversations. Tell your friends all about where to find us, including Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Good Pod, so forth. Don't forget to check out our other offerings, including You Want Me to Watch What in Week 3. Then head over to a YouTube channel to see Geek Cave Plays and the occasional Retromantics. Extra Life is on its way. Just a scant 2 months away now. You heard the song? Go give. All right? Maybe, you know, maybe if we get a donation or two, there'll be a new song next month.
Ooh.
I don't know. So for Kent Harris, our Stan Marsh, for Darren Wright, our Kyle Proflovsky, for Justin White, our Eric Cartman, I'm Chad Savage, our Kenny McCormick. Thanks for listening, and remember, everyone is a geek for something.